following podcast is a part of RadioMisfits.com.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren Lojudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. All right, how's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I am going on tour so soon, and I'm so excited to meet some of you on the road. Listen, I'm going to be in Kalamazoo on March 20th. Then I'm going to be in Cleveland March 22nd, Caledonia March 23rd, Chicago March 26th. Are you in one of these places? Also, I might make March 27th. I might make a pit stop. This would just be me like doing someone else's show on the 27th in Pittsburgh. We'll see. To be determined. However, are you here in one of these places? I would love to meet up with you. So let me know. I love hearing about how other misfits are making it work in other parts of the country. And I love going to the Midwest because y'all are so nice. Oh my God. And of course, you know, like there's weird. I was there last year and I was like, oh my God, there's so many weirdos in the Midwest. It's just like, I feel like sometimes when you feel like you're the only one, you have a hard time. Like when you don't meet, there's not a critical mass. And so I like that the Misfit Variety Show is providing the critical mass of weirdos to the Midwest. We have gotten the call and we are going. Of course, in Chicago, there is a critical mass of weirdos, but you know, it's another space for weirdos. And then out on the road, you know, there's not. It's a big city's habit, but otherwise we're making it. We are making the community. So come be a part of it. You have a friend in any of those places, pass it on. If you'd like me to come to your town, if you feel like there is a need to create spaces for laughs and community, hey, brother misfits, let's do this thing. Let me know. Before we go into the interview, a reminder, please rate and review the podcast because social proof is super important for misfits because misfits trust other misfits to know what's good. Also, sign up at laurenlogie.com to get regular updates on the podcast. And, you know, you can also sponsor a podcast. We make it accessible for individuals or companies. We're putting this out like every 2-3 weeks. We're trying. 2-3 weeks. But listen, if we got a sponsor, we'd be on point. We would put these out more often. So go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast and contact us there. Today, we're interviewing none other than Miyuk, who, you know, is someone who has like these long job descriptions with these things that you've never even heard of anyone doing, like all smushed together. And you're like, how does this person? A lot of times when this happens on someone, like, I don't get it. I don't really get it. But when you meet Miyuk, like, you get it. Miyuk Hikaru is a book doula, a writing mentor, a sacred plant medicine advisor, an integrationist, a life purpose coach and guide, and a taboo artist. I mean, it's creative. She's got the most misfit job, I think, of any guest. She gets the award. She gets the most misfit job award, the coolest job. We talk about it in this episode. I'm sure a lot of you have questions about ayahuasca and plant medicine. And she's got it. She's led many people through the process. She's also an adoptee. We met at the Untangling Our Roots conference last April, which we'll talk more about. And I was immediately impressed by her light, her willingness to share and create space for other people. She's just like an extraordinary individual. And you're going to hear all about how she does what she does. So let's give it up for none other than Miyuk Hikaru. Welcome, Miyuk Hikaru.
Thank you.
Let's make it. We're here. And where are you right now? Because you are international.
We are also queer. Right now, I am in Northwest Arkansas in a place called Fayetteville, which is the fastest growing part of the country at the moment, thanks COVID. But I'm out of here in less than 2 months, going to Oaxaca, Mexico.
Wow. And we're going to get into that. Okay.
We are going to get into that. Yeah.
I'm just Arkansas. That's where you are.
Yes.
I'm scared for you. How is that going? It sounds very scary.
People need to get out of the coastal cities, girl. Like, it's cool here. It's super cool here. Yeah. I mean, there are, just like anywhere, there are things that I don't like, but Boston is more racist than here.
Wow.
It is much more terrifying to live in Boston than here. I feel a lot better here. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, well, can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's strange. Here, the racism is certainly more subdued. Like, mm-hmm. people have quote unquote manners in the sense that it's like, no, I'm going to go home and talk shit about you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be all up in your, you know, it's not going to be an episode of Untucked from Drag Race, you know. But in Boston, people will just scream, you know, like, just scream like, Chinatown, hey, Chinatown, or whatever. I mean, I had a guy follow me in his car down the street for like a mile. I was walking, he was driving.
That's terrifying.
And we were in Brookline Village, which is like very, you know, hoity-toity, where all the Harvard professors live. And he was just like screaming, you know, go back to China, you know, just that kind of stuff. And all these like very Elizabeth Warren, you know, voters, they looked away. And here people would like be like, dude, like there's just kind of a more, I don't know, it's crazy. But yeah, like when people would scream the craziest stuff at me in Boston and all of these like very good liberals would just, boom, I don't exist, looking down at their phones. Yeah.
That reminds me of something my friend said about moving to a, like a out of the way scary place that most people think is scary. He's like, they're the nicest racists I've ever met. They're like, they'll be there.
Yeah.
You need something in their house, like your house, they will be there. They will be there to help you. Car breaks down, they're going to be there.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I think, you know, when we approach people the way we do in coastal places, like it makes them feel alienated because they're like, but I'm nice. Like, how can you start a conversation when, like, they're like, but I'm nice. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. But then let's think about what you're saying at your house and, like, how you really feel and how you vote. And
well, and there's also a certain kind of ignorance here that I find more permissible in some sense. Like, it's like when I go to third world countries and people say things and it's like, yeah, because you can't know.
Yes.
There's no way that you could know. Whereas in cities, it's like, what's your excuse, girl?
Yes, absolutely. 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 And then there's like, and then if you're friendly, then this is an opportunity for exchange. Rather than like someone just being like, no, I'm very defensive. You know, I took a class.
Yeah.
I'm Wesleyan. All right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. And how did you find yourself there?
I graduated from Little Rock Central. I sat next to Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Spanish class.
What?
And yeah, so my best friends were besties with Chelsea Clinton back in the days when that meant something.
Wait,
oh, man,
I'm
got a soundboard and everything.
That's, I have a soundboard. Do you hear it?
Fancy.
I didn't hear it.
I did. I heard it, yeah.
Ah. Okay. Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's not going to me. Okay. I'm glad you heard it.
Yeah.
All right. Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. I graduated from Little Rock Central. My parents moved me here from California when I was 13 to like small town Arkansas. And then I escaped to Little Rock for my senior year of high school. And then I went to Boston.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. So well, let's tell everyone what you do because you have the coolest, coolest career.
I have a cool job. Yeah.
You have a very cool job. So let's tell everyone where your cool job and then we could let them know where you're going. This is so exciting.
Yeah. So I am a psychedelic advisor and integrationist. And I also, I'm a book doula. I help people write their stories. And I am also a life purpose coach. And to me, all of these things in my mind are the same thing. It's about either whether or not you're an actual writer. We all live by narratives, personal narratives, cultural narratives, national narratives, right? And so the path to healing, some people use writing for that. I mean, comics, right? You're like working out your stuff. And so whether you're doing that, you know, personal work through coaching or through writing, and then when you're using plant medicine and you're not using it for recreational purposes, then that can get you there faster.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So then what kind of plant medicine? Tell us more about that.
So I've sort of straddled the line in a way. I've worked with ayahuasca in indigenous traditions for quite some time. But I also, like, I lived in Boston, so I worked with Harvard people. So I've also worked with like ketamine and MDMA. And I've worked within that psychotherapeutic model, which I think is categorically different from the plant medicine or the sacred medicine model. It doesn't just treat from the neck up. I mean, I'm curing my autoimmune disease and I've seen people cure their cancer and all that kind of stuff. So the plant medicine or the sacred medicine visionary model is much more like holistic.
Interesting. So psychotherapeutics is like, how can you like, I guess, give us like a cheat sheet on the difference?
Well, you know, the FDA, they approved ketamine and psilocybin, you know, for anxiety and depression. And so it's, you know, and when you get prescribed these things, it's working generally with like a psychotherapist. And so it's mostly in the mental health arena. You know, it's usually not like a medical doctor being like, oh, you have like ovarian cysts. Okay, well, let's get you some ketamine. You know what I mean? So the plant medicine model is it doesn't really separate mind body in that way.
Gotcha.
And it's much, in my opinion, it's much, much deeper. And it's from these traditions that are like thousands and thousands of years old.
I've been to Costa Rica a bunch, and there's a lot of people who go there and other places too. And they're like, I'm going to do ayahuasca and I'm going to vomit all over myself.
Yeah. Cool.
Be in the fetal position, cry a lot.
Uh-huh.
How is it good? I guess explain to me, like, what's the appeal? Cause it seems really intense.
It can be, it can also be beautiful. I mean, I went to this retreat and one of my Palapa mates was this beautiful, sweet older woman. And she came and like her face was gray. Like she was just, there was this grayness and sadness about her, like just almost like the epitome of grief. And after the last ceremony, she was glowing like she was pregnant. I was like, woman, what happened to you? And she was like, I went to heaven last night. And I was like, you sure as hell did. Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. I went to hell, but good for you, you know?
Yes. I mean, it's like so many stories of people like overcoming PTSD, like there's depression.
Yeah.
So many stories.
I think the appeal is that it's sort of like, you know, when you mature to a certain point, you realize that many of the things worth having in life take work. You know, it's like the child who wants the quick fix and for things to be easy. But, you know, the things we cherish most in life and value are hard won. And so to me, the way that these medicines work, the paradigm is sort of the opposite of addiction, where addiction is you're trying to soothe a pain. You're trying to do it, you know, and in a way it's a band-aid. Whereas with this work, you intentionally go into the suffering to move through it and then you're free.
Wow.
So it's sort of a, it's short, instead of Jesus Christ, instead of, short-term pleasure to address long-term pain, it's short-term pain for lifetime freedom. You know, it's just,
does the effects stick? Like, do they stick in?
Yeah. Again, that a lot of that depends on the work that you put in terms of integration. So that's why I'm really a big fan of integration work, because you can go and you can have this magical week or, you know, however long you're actively working in ceremonies. And then you get back home. And, you know, if you go back into your old habits, then there you are again. You know, the beautiful thing about these medicines is that they can open you to see, and then you can't unsee. So some degree, you can't then go back and live the same way because now you have this additional information. And often that seeing is through the heart space. You know, it's through the eyes of compassion and, you know, just like an older, more mature view rather than like a wounded little child. And that's a much better way to go through life.
Yeah, for sure. It's like doing what therapy does in like years and like such a compressed time.
In a way, I'd say one bigger difference, not that they don't do group therapy, is that the plant medicine model is very much, it very much focuses on the collective healing aspect, right? So it's not so, I guess, narcissistic, or, I mean, therapy was started by like the great narcissist. And so when you have healing in a group, it's amazing, not only because of the empathy, but because so much of what we suffer from, especially in this society, is isolation, alienation.
Thumbs up.
And so there's this, I'm going to kick, I love your soundboard. And so when you're in the circle and you're hearing someone and you're like, that's my story. She had my mom. She had my childhood. There's something just healing about that, and to having a witness and having that validation. And to do that in the kind of safe space that I don't think exists in this culture. Like the work that I see done at these retreats are, I can't imagine that sort of healing, including mine. There isn't a space that I know of that that could have happened, where that you have that level of support to really work it out and stop making other people's lives miserable.
Heard that.
Including you.
Heard that. Now, what you say plant medicines, because we're talking about ayahuasca. Is there anything else you're working with?
Well, ayahuasca comes with its own pharmacy.
Oh.
So the, you know, in the Western world, ayahuasca takes up a lot of the bandwidth because it's a quote unquote psychedelic. But ayahuasca is actually a door that opens to an entire pharmacy of plants, most of which are not psychoactive at all. So they're not, you know, necessarily clickbaity things to talk about. But ayahuasca is often used in conjunction with these other medicines.
And what are the other, can you tell us what they are?
There's like the entire Amazon jungle.
Wow, so they're Amazon based.
For the most part, yeah. But one of the things that I'm doing is I'm trying to expand that to plants in North America, you know, the plants that were sacred to Native American tribes. I'd like to move that to Asia, Southeast Asia, and start to explore those plants as well. That's something that I'm really interested in.
And now how is this information taught? So where would you go to expand?
So it's interesting. These are lineage based. You know, I mean, you can go and, you know, do a psychotherapy degree and go to like some sort of, you know, integration psychotherapy school. But in these lineage based programs, every family has its own system and its own teachings, and there is kind of a common ground, but every lineage has its own way of working with things. And so it's sort of like, I guess in the West, maybe it's a little bit like when you apprentice, you know, anything where you become a journeyman, or I think of it as like chef, when you work under a chef, you know, you're learning that particular way, and it's still food and it's still high cuisine, but every chef has a signature, and like, maybe you're going to work with salmon a little bit differently or something like that. And so that's kind of more of the you know, because we call the shamans, they call themselves maestras, they're masters, you know, so it's kind of like that in, it's kind of like the chef system, I guess, in Europe, and maybe a little bit like in martial arts.
Mm-hmm. You it's know, like a sensei, with a, right?
Yeah. With a master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. That's really cool. And then, like, so you have to go find the lineage. How do you go about finding, like, the lineage, the family?
That's tricky. Oh, it's tricky. It's very, very tricky because it's a different culture. There are so many factors that Westerners don't even know to consider because it's outside of our awareness.
Yeah.
Usually I say, you know, if you can go through somebody who's word of mouth, or you look for places that sound and feel really credible. So I work with Soltara, which is an ayahuasca healing center in Costa Rica. You know, they have Gabor Mate and Dennis McKenna on the board. They have a really robust screening process where you, to go there, and the reason it is so safe is because, you know, you have to go through approval with an MD and a psychologist. You know, there are these different levels. They don't just let anybody in because they want your money. And so, yeah. And then the shamans that they work with, they have really good relationships with them. They treat them very well. And they are familiar with the landscape of Peru. And so these people are very well vetted in a way that's sort of hard because the stuff is still kind of Wild West. And it is a totally different culture.
Like, how does someone who's interested in this kind of thing avoid the fakes? Because I assume that there's some fakey fakes out there.
There's some fakes. It's strange because in order to find a really good teacher, they have to have a combination of qualities. They need to not only be competent and properly trained, but they also really need to have their ish together. Like there's a lot of, just like with any quote unquote sacred space, right? There's an opening for abuse. So you do hear those stories. People get really into their egos because they do have a lot of power and a lot of authority that's unchecked. And so it's like, you try to do your homework, but this is like indigenous. So, you know, you can't just go by every TripAdvisor review and stuff like that. I mean, half of the healers in Peru don't work with Westerners at all. So the half that are willing to work with us. Yeah, it's a tricky thing. And that's one reason that I do what I do, because I do try to keep my ear to the ground. You do hear about really good places, but then I know things about the shamans because it's underground, right? It's like with Harvey Weinstein, there was like a whisper network, and there were lots of people who knew, but it wasn't, you wouldn't have found it on a website. You had to be kind of connected to the bubble some way. And so I try to, you know, stay in at the edges of the bubble and try to know what's going on. And I have people in networks too. And I try to present myself as somebody who can be really trusted, because there are certain people that, you know, when people are abused or hurt, they don't tell, because you can sense if you can tell somebody or not. And so I try to be really open and try to, you know, let people know that I'm someone you can tell.
It's beautiful. And then you're moving to Oaxaca. Tell us. I'm so excited for you. I really want to come visit you there. I'm not sure about ayahuasca, and I'll talk about that later, but I just want to hang. It'd be so fun.
Yeah, totally. I've never been there. I was looking for a place to do this 1-year training with my shamans, and it needed to be kind of a sanctuary. And it needed to be a place where I could really chill out for mm-hmm. a year and not be living in a city and mm-hmm. not be really super stressed about money. And I, you know, just a place where I could really focus and be kind of cloistered and monastic. Mm-hmm. And this amazing place fell into my lap for like pennies. And so, so I said yes. And now I'm moving in less than 2 months.
Hell yeah. I love that. And then you're having retreats there. You're hosting retreats as well.
I'm going to be hosting retreats in Costa Rica. So I'm going to be much closer to Costa Rica. And I'm also going to be hosting retreats next year in Peru. And I will be much closer to Peru. So
not in Oaxaca.
No, so the Shipibo, yep. who are the tribe that I work with, they live in Peru.
Gotcha. So do you feel like you have to go to the place where this work is being done?
I think it's important to go to land, to do it on land where it is permissible, I guess, like where it's legal, where it's where the shamans, there is something about going to the home of the medicine, but you do have to be careful because like you said, there are like so many just, hey, you want to drink some ayahuasca? Like let's go. I'm a shaman. Yeah. you know, yeah. But Costa Rica is also really beautiful. They've really opened up. I think my friend went to some event and the person who used to be their like minister of art or something like that drank ayahuasca. So, So I think it's important to go outside of your own, you know, they talk about set and setting. Mm. And usually what they mean when they say that is setting is like, you want to do in a quiet place. You don't want to be at a party kind of thing. But to me, it means leaving the West and leaving the environment that made you sick in the first place. Mm. And so to me, the context for these medicines is indigenous. It is collective. It is that it is rooted in what humans originally are and were, mm-hmm. as opposed to, I don't know, whatever kind of concrete jungle we've built here.
And so I'm someone who has done some psychedelics. Like I've done, I did some LSD, some mushrooms. Mushrooms was like always like pretty chill. But when I did like something like LSD, which is more of like a, I feel like a more intense experience, I felt really like my brain was going to places that scared me because I felt like, could I come back? And that's what makes me terrified of ayahuasca. And I guess there's probably a lot of people who did stuff and that, like not ceremonially, not like controlled, like, and who knows the quality too. Like, I don't know. I have no idea. So what do you say to them? Like about doing ayahuasca, how is it different? Should we be afraid? Like, does it mean we're a candidate to go like super cuckoo from this? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think there's a healthy fear, right? Like there's a healthy respect for the unknown. Mm-hmm. You know, like they call it a trip. There's a healthy respect for traveling to a new country that you've never been to. And there's a certain amount of preparation that you can do for yourself as well to make sure that you're safe. But also so much of this work is really about surrendering mm-hmm. to our experience, trusting what the plants are bringing up for us. In the West, we tend to limit our view of these experiences by calling them a bad trip or a good trip. Whereas usually a bad trip, what we talk about, what we're calling a bad trip is actually, it's trying to help you.
Yeah.
These medicines are trying to show you something really dark within you so that you can heal it, but you're resisting it. And when you resist it, that's going to be a long night.
Yes.
And you're going to consider it to be a bad trip.
Yeah.
But again, if you're working with people who not only know how to work with the medicines in a shamanic way, in an energetic way, who are rooted, in my opinion, in an indigenous tradition. And then you also have facilitators outside of that space to really hold that space for you and also work with you when, if you do get to a place where you're like, wow, this is really intense. Right. Can you help, you know, just someone who's seen it over and over again. And the thing is, with this medicine, unlike Western medicine, no one's asking you to do anything they haven't themselves done. Mm. Everyone talking to you has been there. Wow. So everything you're getting is from experience. Every shaman I've worked with almost died.
Wow.
And the plants cured their illness. So when they're asking me to do some really hard stuff, I'm like, okay, well, you did it. You know, it's not like some doctor asking you to do chemo and, you know, even though most doctors actually wouldn't do chemo and wouldn't let their family members do chemo. So it's just kind of the opposite. But I think there's a healthy amount of fear for sure.
Yeah.
And in terms of fearing that you won't come back or something like that, there's kind of two ways to look at it. One is if you're afraid you're not going to come back to being able to function in the world, or you're going to have some sort of psychotic break, that's one reason that you do proper screenings. Mm. You go to a place who's going to properly screen you by professionals who can look at your medical history, the prescriptions you've been on throughout your life, all that kind of stuff. So that if it's not going to be safe for you legit, then they'll tell you and you can know that that's not for you, at least not at this time. And then another way of looking at it as well is usually when people come to these medicines, it's because they're unhappy or they're stuck or there's something that they just don't want to live with anymore. And yet we still kind of hang on to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so another way of looking at it is to ask yourself, what am I afraid that I'm not going to be able to bring back with me? Because that's usually the thing that you're going to be asked to surrender. And that's usually the thing that's holding you back.
That's fascinating. See, I'm like, what? Oh my God, if I would have done ayahuasca, I don't know what it would have been like, because here's the thing, Mike, I think it was trying to tell me something, because I was being gaslit about my genetic origins and like, why don't I look like anyone in the family? It's like, it's all in your head. You exaggerate.
Oh, no.
So it's like,
oh, no.
And I didn't have DNA evidence to prove otherwise.
We need the RuPaul's thing where the.
So that's a boo for the gaslighting.
That's a big boo.
It's like, big boo for sure. It's like,
I'm sorry.
So it's like, I was having all of these, like, I had lots of experiences where it was like, I remember having an experience with EMDR, which has like a, like you go into it in a process, and I had a, like a thing, like you get these like, not to say visions, but like sort of in your innermost vision, eye, third eye.
It's like a hypnagogic state.
Yeah. And I went into my house where I grew up and I looked at myself in a bassinet and I was like, this is where it started. In order to understand this, I have to know what happened here.
Yeah.
And it was like, again, still hadn't like gone through my DNA results, still didn't understand what really happened.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's so hard because it's like I was going through and I would go to my therapist and be like, something's wrong with me and we need to figure it out. Hmm. So like, I'm glad I didn't go to ayahuasca because it's like, I don't know how I could have understood what my subconscious was telling me. I guess when someone is not sure of their genetic origins and they're having this situation where nothing, the truth isn't out, would you recommend they do ayahuasca?
I recommend ayahuasca to anyone who feels the call, you know, and if they're where you're talking about, I would say do more research because like, you don't want to talk anyone into doing anything. This is like a, it's like Jeff Ross, what he talks about, who he roasts. You can't be like, roast her. It's like, no, I take volunteers only. If you say roast me, I will roast you. And I feel like the plants are similar. It's like, if you're asking me to work with you, then yes, I will work with you. But I'm not going to talk you into it because what is at the core of this particular, I think, medical paradigm is that you are trying to get in touch with your own agency and your own inner knowing. And so, you know, as an intelligent person, you do your research, you see that it's pretty safe. If it's done, it's extremely safe. If it's done with people who know what they're doing, and then you feel like you've had contact with people that you really resonated with, who sound like they know what they're talking about, who you feel mm-hmm. really comfortable and safe with, then you trust your inner knowing and say, okay, I'm going to go drink ayahuasca with these people. And this is the thing that's going to help me. But so many of us have had our agency taken from us. And so we're out there, we're people pleasers, we're ignoring our own instincts and saying yes when we want to say no, or saying no when we want to say yes. And so it's about kind of bringing ourselves back into that alignment of who we really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, what is it like being a queer person in the space? Like, is it, I don't know how, shamans cool? Like, what's the deal? Like, are they, you know, waving the pride flag? Like, how does it work? How does it go?
It's really interesting. You know, it's something I think about, and it's something that is talked about because these cultures, the thing is it's not just one way. It's not like, oh, we're the bad colonizers and we need to, like, these are people too, and they have their own cultures. And they, you know, the Shipibo live in a pretty heteronormative paradigm. Like, that's literally how they survived genocide after genocide. Like, mm-hmm. that's how their culture works. There are obviously gay Shipibo, just like there's any other gay whatever.
We're everywhere.
You can't get rid of us. We are queer. And so, but on another level, it's all energy. Mm-hmm. And what I think is particularly interesting about being a queer person in this space is that so much of it is about deconstructing the ego. Mm-hmm. And deconstructing these identities. And so I find that I'm in my most healed place when I'm actually letting go of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that I can't care about politics or be socially engaged, but it's to say that that's also in a greater context of things. Mm-hmm. And I get really... when I don't remember that, then I can get really tunnel vision and lost and in my ego and really triggered mm-hmm. by other people's political views rather than curious and open and compassionate. And so I think it can really help being a queer person or any marginalized person, because as an adoptee, as a BIPOC, as whatever it is that you are, you have already done some of the work of thinking about your identity. Mm. Right. Whereas if you've just kind of never had to question it because you are the dominant narrative of your culture, mm-hmm. That's going to be new for you. And it's going to be maybe harder for you, too.
Yeah. So you're an adoptee, right?
I am. And I never had your problem because I was raised by white people. So that whole genetic gaslighting was not really
very
possible.
Clear. My parents, well, they're like short little Italians and I'm very tall, as you know. And they had a theory. They were like, okay, the Vikings invaded Sicily.
Wow, that's a stretch.
Yeah, 350 years ago, they did it. And then comes you. I don't know. It's crazy, right?
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So you knew always?
I knew, yeah.
And
it was hard not to.
Yes.
It was hard not to. There was like no way. I've been like, yeah, you're my real dad. No. Yeah.
Were they cool about talking about it?
Yes. That's very cool. Very open. My mother was so encouraging. She's such a rarity, especially for that generation. Mm-hmm. But nothing was hidden. Everything, I was the head of it, whatever I wanted to do. It was like, let's do it. Whenever I was interested in Korea or adoption stuff, my mother was thrilled. Like, she, I think, wanted me to be more into it, but she didn't want to like take the lead so that I was doing it because she wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think she wanted to meet my birth mother more than I did. Like, she was really into it.
Did you meet your birth mother?
I did.
What was that like, if I may ask?
It was difficult, as it always is. My story was, it was really difficult to meet her. It's something I've written about. I haven't published it yet, but the thing is that when you go to meet your birth mother, you are not going to be hearing, it's not going to be a rom-com. You know what I mean? Like, nobody gives away their child because things are going well. Mm-hmm. So you go into it knowing you're going to meet someone who has suffered a death.
Mm.
And you're going to be showing up as a resurrection of some sort, who is going to be bringing up things that they may not even be aware of. And you're going to be in the space because, you know, biologically, people remind people of, you know, it's like people look at their sons and they see their fathers at that age, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, I walked in there and I was adopted by an evangelical couple. Wow. And so some aspects of it were wild. You know, I walk in, we don't bear a genetic, I mean, I wouldn't have known her from anyone. There were other Koreans I look way more like. So I'm guessing I look like my father. And she was extremely Pentecostal, mega churchy kind of lady, very poor, and very kind of a sucker for a televangelist, and a huge Trump supporter, which was like, wow, plot twist.
Yeah.
Cause I think she thought that, you know, he was going to save them from North Korea or something. I don't know. We didn't really discuss politics, but it was, so it was really interesting. I saw kind of a lot of global history converge there. I did get some really valuable information, but it was very, she had a lot of armor on. Mm. And I did too, as a reaction. I was lucky because I wasn't looking for a mother, at least, mm-hmm. when I went to meet her. But yeah, but it was hard to meet your birth mother and she doesn't like you.
Fuck. Yeah.
But I also didn't really like her.
Right.
but I also realized that what I didn't like was, you know, everything that, all the different ways that she dealt with the trauma of having to give me up. So, you know, at least I did have that awareness and understanding.
Yeah.
But it was hard.
In some ways, she didn't know you.
You're a stranger.
Yeah.
No, you're total strangers. There's such an emphasis on biology mm-hmm. and DNA mm-hmm. in our culture. And I think it's because it often gives people, it often operates as a scapegoat so that people don't have to take responsibility and accountability because it's like, genetics.
Yeah.
It's just genetics. It's just blood. And it's just like, actually, you know, I have my mom's laugh. We have the same crappy taste in music. You know, I mean, so many things about, because when you are adopted, you do get to see that clear distinction between what is nature and what is nurture. And like 99% is nurture, girl.
Yeah, it's a lot of nurture in there. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen so many people. I've seen, my ex. Yeah, like her mom would be like, you know, all of these, you got the worst genes, so you're not going to be. And she named all these things that you couldn't be, or the negative things about her that we're never going to change. That's just your luck. That's what you got. Yeah. It's like, you're just dragging her down to your level, woman.
Yeah.
It was painful to watch. It was just painful, painful. And like she had the kid thinking like, you know, my ex, that no one will ever love you like I do. Ay, ay, ay. Mm. It was.
Yeah. That's a powerful story.
Yeah.
I was surprised though, when I was in Korea, there were certain things that were very primal that woke up in me. I mean, I know a lot of people love Korean food because it's kind of the best, but there was something almost like ancient that I was aware of. And I was just like, wow, I also really like bad music, guys. And,
right.
You know, and there were just certain things about some of the spaces and the way they felt. I was like, wow, I, I kind of am Korean in certain ways.
I feel that. I went to Britain and I fell in love with an English girl. And I was like, my genetics. I was like, oh, I'm so attracted to the Brits. It's just in you.
Huh.
Something
interesting.
Something's in you. That's where my genetic dad is from.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Not dad.
Okay.
Yeah. Is England.
Yeah.
England, Britain.
I mean, I'm scared of that stuff. I mean, I think Koreans are beautiful. Like, they're beautiful people. But I'm like, we could be related. Like, that's deal breaker.
Okay.
I'm related to this entire country. No thanks.
Yeah. DNA test. Like, spit in a tube. Let's go. Yeah, it's that is to be worried about for sure in all of it. So you're about to do an initiation, right?
I am. I'm about to do a one-year initiation as an ayahuascara, which is the training that people go through to be able to serve medicine, pour medicine and all of that. But that's, I'm not going to be doing that. I'm doing it for my own journey that I'm on. And also because the plants are calling me to do that. But also it's not going to hurt me. It's going to help me be a better facilitator. Especially now that I'm hosting and leading ayahuasca retreats at Saltara. And it's everything's been working up to this. I've dieted. Mm-hmm. It's called dieting. I've dieted 7 plants, and my last diet was closer to 6 months. And so I'm ready for a year. And that's going to be kind of wild.
Dieting mean you ate 6 plants a lot or something?
No, dieting is, there's a diet element of it, but it's more of like a protocol.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a
lot. It's very, you can't touch people. You don't really have a lot of outside stimulation. You don't watch TV. You don't do a lot of, you don't read books so much. You really kind of, it's like kind of like a meditation in a way, you know, and you're eating really plain food and stuff like that.
I went to a meditation retreat through Insight Meditation Society, and it was similar, like no reading, writing, no screens, obviously, no talking, no eye contact. It was profound. In fact, I had like a psychedelic experience, which is another reason. Like I had this vision of like all of these like bugs just coming out of my mouth. Like, just like coming out of really fast, really fast. And it was like, and then I opened my eyes because it was getting very intense. And then it ended. I'm like, oh my God, what would it be like with ayahuasca? But there is something about that is naturally like sort of ejects a lot of stuff from you.
Well, in all of these ancient traditions, I think if we go far enough back, all these different traditions, just like Pangea.
Mm-hmm.
When all the continents broke apart. And so there's kind of, you know, in my mind, there's kind of one spiritual tradition. Like, I'm very convinced that ayahuasca and Ayurveda were once part of a single medical system, for example. But and so you look at all these ancient traditions, and some of them, they have different like emphases, like meditation or, you know, sitting in the dark in a cave with ayahuasca. With the Shipibo tradition, you drink ayahuasca at night once it's dark. And the ceremony can go pretty long, but once the sun comes up, that's the bell, you know? I mean, it's not, especially if people have already done work in these other spaces, you know, like Kundalini. There are many roads that lead to Rome. So,
Now, what's your, we talk about here, misfit moment, the moment when you knew that the traditional life was not for you?
Ooh, I think it was when my youth pastor was busted for trying to take a bunch of us into a cult. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm not going to be a Bible beater anymore. Maybe I'm not going to be the good evangelical adoptee anymore. I'm out of here.
What did he say to get you into a cult?
He didn't say anything. I wasn't one of the chosen, but he got caught trying to take some kids to India. Some other parents saw like plane tickets to India. And And so then there was part of me that was like, why wasn't I invited into the cult? But
why wasn't I like, was kidnapped?
Screw this guy. You know, I thought we were friends. And I think that was the moment. And then it was just kind of Trent Reznor for a while.
Mm.
I went into my Nine Inch Nails phase.
Good phase to have. Good
you
phase.
Know, yeah.
I love it. He led you out into glory.
Yeah. Great service to me.
And we also talk about the misfit inspiration, misspiration, if you will. The thing you do, like, when you're in the lulls, things, a creative life, a different life is difficult, can be difficult, has its own set of obstacles. So what do you do? What has got you down?
I have a really beautiful circle.
Mm.
A really beautiful connection and network of people who are very clear and who really see me and sometimes tell me the hard things in a compassionate way because they know it will help me, even though it's hard to hear. And I'll check in with them. You know, they see me, they see my light, they see my challenges. And sometimes I'll just get really quiet and connect to my plants as well. I'll read. I'll read something that I really love by a voice from long ago that really speaks to me. Anything that really will remind me who I am.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't surprise me you have an amazing circle because you just have such a beautiful light. I remember when we met, you sat down next to me and we started talking. And it was like you just kind of pulled me into this peace, you know, and it was a hard conference for me because it was the first time. And since I was doing so much hosting, like I didn't realize how emotionally difficult it would be for me to like hold that space and then get off stage and then be stopped a lot, which I'm happy. I really want to talk to people, but like emotionally I was drained after. And also I am a little bit like, in a rush always, like it's just my thing.
You're from New
York.
So
it's like, I'm always like, you know, I'm like, all right, hi. And then I feel awkward too. There's awkwardness of like, I don't know what else to say, you know? And so there's awkwardness and I'm always in a rush in my head. And and then there's emotional exhaustion. And so it was, I know some people might've seen me as like maybe being disinterested or not engaged or maybe had, you know, but I feel like you just were perfect because I was like, I just need someone to just sit and share space. And you were perfect. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, you were doing a lot of work there. I just got to be there.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, to be in the eye and also for it to be your first conference like that too, there was a lot to take in. There was a lot of, I mean, I spent a good deal of time just in my hotel room regrounding.
And I didn't know a lot of stuff. I didn't know all the, like about the adoptions. Like I didn't realize the scandals and I was just like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't talked about this publicly yet. I'm still figuring out how to talk about this stuff, but I do think that I was part of some child trafficking. Yeah. There's actually a book coming out by a journalist from the Boston Globe who I've been in contact with. My story is not in the book, but but it's a market. Mm-hmm. And for every market, there's a black market.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. It's intense. Like I want to have a conversation with someone. I'll just say this to be anonymous, but he has a brother who's adopted, who doesn't want to talk to him anymore. And he like kind of took it hard. But I think like they don't realize like how much of it like didn't go like not it doesn't always go down well, like, and I don't know how they were dealing with that trauma of it happening. And you could think, oh, whatever, we were fine to that person, but they might be dealing with the fact that how they were adopted was not in the most like free and like conformed consent way. You have to have a lot of empathy for the situation because he's kind of angry.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody is in a marginalized position where in terms of power dynamic, that would be the adoptee, and they feel that you're in the wrong somehow, it never hurts just to learn more. mm-hmm. about their world. Because sometimes what, you know, those people are feeling is it's just the sheer ignorance of it. And you're on such a different level because you're living according to this completely other narrative, whether it's the white savior narrative or mm-hmm. whatever it may be. And so there isn't even a place, and that the adoptee would have to do so much emotional labor
yes.
to even talk about the thing. And so the more work you can do to say, hey, I speak the language, I know what's real, this isn't a shock to me, I've read stories, to try to meet them halfway as best as you can. But yeah, I mean, otherwise you're just kind of staying within your own little gated community
yep.
and saying, wow, well, from my point of view, and then you're talking to the bubble and everyone's validating you.
Yes. Like, didn't we do so much for this kid? Da, 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 da. It's like, yeah, you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's zoom out, guys.
Yeah. Speaking of someone difficult, Melania Trump is here in a 2024 election.
In your apartment?
Yeah, she's here. She's here. Oh my God.
What?
Melania.
Hey.
Melania. Hello. So, how can I make someone, ayahuasca, I assume, is a liquid, right?
It is. It's a tea.
Oh, okay. So what if I use it? What if I put something in so strong to someone's drink that they can overdose and have psychotic break and give me a break lifelong? I want a lifelong break. Is that possible?
Well, I wouldn't give it to the other person. It's very safe, so there wouldn't be an overdose. You can't really overdose. But you can take it yourself, my dear, and it would do wonders. It's the best detox you could imagine. Your skin will be amazing. You will feel very light by the end of it.
I pay treatments for skin, and that I see the trick. You're trying to get me be introspective. I can't believe this. I'm not going to complain to Lauren. She brings me to these people who say, oh, you have to look at your life. Oh, you have to do some inner work. I didn't become a Trump. Listen, I don't do the orange things. Okay, I have to deal with orange things that are unspeakable to have to then think of myself in any way. So. But great job doing what you're doing. Great with medicines. I will look elsewhere for overdose possibilities. Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
Oh, bye bye.
Yeah, she's sad. All right, so
that woman. Ooh, life. You know, hashtag choices.
Choices. She's like, I am choosing to be the veil. I want the veil. I'm pulling it down. I'm like black. He's painting it with black paint.
Yep. She definitely made some decisions there.
Yeah. So now, if someone wants to decide to go to the light, how do we find your work and follow you?
Well, everything's on my website, holdingcompassionate.space. They can find out about the retreat that I'm hosting in November for ayahuasca. They can learn about the different services that I offer. They can see me on fabulous podcasts like yours. They can find out where I am on social media, where I live in the virtual space. Excellent. And they can read my writing, all of that stuff.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to following you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logie. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogie.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The preceding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes,
Stitcher Radio,
and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.